Now, I suppose you all know how ordinary television works. You photograph something.
Sure, I do. You photograph something, then the photograph is split up into millions of tiny pieces, and they go whizzing through the air down to your TV set where they're all put together again in the right order.
You should open your mouth a little wider when you speak.
Love to watch TV, Mike?
You bet.
You like the killings, huh?
What do you think life's all about?
Insert music here. Hey everybody, welcome to Mike TV episode 20, in which we are finally covering Preacher, AMC's Preacher, season 4, episode 10, the finale, the series finale entitled End of the World. Yes, we've had a mini hiatus. I apologize for that. My work schedule has gotten in the way, I'm afraid. But never fear, Dean and I are here for you. Hello, Dean.
Hey, Lisa, how are you doing today?
I am fantastic, and I am so excited to speak with you, and thank you for being patient with me, and thanks for coming on to talk about Preacher today. I already missed this show. How did you like this episode?
I liked it overall. I was confused through some of it in the beginning. It jumps around a lot, but then it does kind of wrap itself up at the end, so I was happy with it.
For a finale, you know, it's hard for shows to wrap up, but I think for 4 seasons of this show, which is, I think, more than any fan of the comic books could have ever hoped for, and for a finale, I think it did it right. It was a good way to wrap up everything and didn't leave really anything dangling, right?
Yeah, spoiler alert, like everybody dies.
Some people perhaps should have died and didn't. So we will get into that. All right. Well, let's go into it scene by scene, because as you remarked when you saw my notes, there are a lot of them. And I don't want to miss a beat, because there were so many fun moments to this episode. And it was a longer episode, but it did go by quickly, I thought. I thought it was fast paced for everything it had to do. It kept the pace.
Yeah, I actually felt like it seemed like it had just so much jammed in that it had to be fast paced. It seemed like there was more in the episode than what was actually even there, I think.
Yeah, and I've watched it 3 times now, and I can say honestly, each time I pick up something, another little something. So they even peppered this with Easter eggs that I hope I've caught them all. Maybe you've caught some that I've missed, and I'm sure hopefully our listeners will even let us know some that we've missed. So we open in North Dakota. We get the title screen, North Dakota. There's a lady in a Jeep entering an Air Force base. She has all the ID and paperwork. And then we see her in the control room, and there's another guy in there. He's checking his credentials. And then there's another couple of gentlemen sitting on stools in front of, you know, like when you see like a nuke room, they're sitting there with all the levers and the buttons in front of them. And so simultaneously, they rip off their disguises, the woman standing who's driven in the Jeep and the man who's already in there, and reveal that they are Grail officers, and they immediately shoot the other two people in the room. And then they resume position in front of 2 little TV monitors that are there at the control panel. And they turn on the TV and start watching the Apocalypse Review, which we see now has 9 minutes on the clock counting down. And, there's a man playing bagpipes on the stage. So I'm sure everybody's being greatly entertained by that.
Yeah, I was hoping it'd turn on and Paula Poundstone would be in the middle of her act.
I know. I really, you know, we should have a list here of things that really maybe didn't pay off. And the Paula Poundstone thing was one of them. And I'm going to say it now so I don't forget, but help me remember. But the Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski, also, yep.
I really regret that we did not get more on that. It's one of my favorite movies, of course. So anyway, we are back in Humperdew's dressing room. He's in there and he's very worried about going on stage. And Cassidy's trying to ease his mind and tells him, don't worry, you're a dead ringer for Gene Kelly. And, of course, you know, Humperdew is dressed up wearing a top hat and a suit and a tie and holding a cane, like, you know, his dancing cane. He's ready for his soft shoe. He's got those gold shoes on. But yeah, Cassidy says, you're a dead ringer for Gene Kelly. And then under his breath says, if Gene Kelly had been struck by lightning. The camera pans over and we see God's in the dressing room also. And he laughs at that joke and then mutters something about how he could tell them stories about Gene Kelly. But then God jumps up and he kisses Humperdoo and says, okay, it's time. I don't want to miss the show. And he starts to leave the dressing room. And as he's leaving, Cassidy says, you know, why don't you just do it yourself? Why don't you just blow up the world yourself? And God says, you know, humanity has to do their part. It's free will. That's the fun. And then as God leaves, Cassidy says, oh, he likes to watch. And then we see God join the crowd of other Grail folk out in the stadium, and they are ready for their Messiah.
Yeah, it did seem like there's, you know, one of those kind of unwritten or unsaid rules that God just can't destroy the world himself. Like he
likes to watch, Dean.
Yeah, but he even had the chance later if he wanted to, and he just never does. So, yeah, I guess that's his whole thing.
He takes the time to destroy something else, so we'll get there. He clearly wanted to destroy something. He had kill on the brain.
Yeah.
All right, so next scene, Jesse and the Saint, who are still in the church, are fighting, and Jesse is not faring well against the Saint. The Saint is just throwing him around, throwing him on the ground. Finally, the Saint has the Jesse on the ground. He pulls the gun on him, and Jesse just says, okay, go on then. But I'm telling you, the parents will not be happy. And in walks Effendi the angel and his demon lover. They're both holding large swords, and Jesse says, looks like someone brought a gun to a knife fight. Classic Jesse. We knew we were going to get the throwdown between, I mean, this is another one of those things that was a lot to cram in, the throwdown with the angel and the demon fighting the Saint. So cut to Featherstone. She is with Tulip in that closet that she has just broken into or opened the door to that Tulip was locked in. She is telling her backstory to Tulip. So we get this big close-up of her face. She's all teary-eyed. She's saying these funny things about her past. I mean, they sound funny. Really, they're not. About how she started out in Knoxville, Tennessee. She actually also has a little bit of a different accent here, too, so allowing her real accent to come through. She started out in Knoxville, Tennessee, doing anything she could to make money, you know, sleeping with cops, stealing from eighth graders, the things you do. But then she says she was just lost until she met Klaus. And then Tulip remarks, oh yeah, nothing like humorless cruelty to get you going. And Featherstone then attempts to pull a gun out and shoot herself in the head, but the gun is locked up or jammed or something. And so then Featherstone sits down in a chair, starts crying, and says, damn it, Sarah, you can't do anything right. So we're learning, maybe for the first time, their first name is Sarah. It feels like that was established early on, but I can't remember. And so Tulip takes the gun from her and, you know, talks about how guns like that jam up all the time. And of course, she knows how to fix it. So she's talking to Featherstone as she's fixing it. And she says, you know, that it's time to do something that's just right for you, Featherstone, not for religion or for any man. And that's not selfish at all. It's just righteous. And by this time, she's fixed the gun. And then she says, but I'm going to keep this. And Featherstone has a funny line. She says, it's okay. I've got tons of them.
Yeah.
And then Tulip leaves the room, and then just this hilarious little silent moment, and that body that's been in the wall the whole time, the one that God threw into the wall when they first came into that office, then that just hilariously slips out of the wall and falls.
Yeah, I thought for sure we'd see them team up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Instead of just an advice, you know, crying and then giving advice, but yeah.
You know, we got that great fight scene between the two of them. I think it was back in episode one, perhaps, or for sure episode two. And I think we have been clamoring for more. I did feel a little underwhelmed by that, too. I kind of expected them, even if they went their separate ways, to team up again. And definitely did not like what is coming next for Featherstone. So we will get there. We start getting a lot of quick cut scenes. So first, Jesus and Hitler are still in their crazy fighting brawl. So they're just, you know, I mean, that is just a full-on brawl. And then there's a scene where Hairstar is still desperately on the phone with the fax machine support, begging his representative, Adnan, not to put him on hold. He's just saying, no, Adnan, don't put me on hold, Adnan. This is very funny. God is in the stands watching the countdown. There's a couple of Grail people in front of him. We learn that they're a married couple. They turn around, recognize God, say, oh, we're a big fan. And then, hey, could we bend your ear for a minute? Because we have a lot of questions. God is visibly annoyed at this. Then we cut to the announcement for the Messiah over the intercom, and Cassidy tells Humperdue it's showtime. Humperdue is still being his Humperdue self. He's still very nervous acting, and finally he does kind of utter out a no, and then he throws his cane down and runs and hides in a rack of clothes in there. It's a very funny moment because Cassidy is telling him, no, no, don't go hide in the clothes.
Yes, I feel like I have to say this to my five-year-old every time we're in a department store.
Yes, it feels exactly like that. And, of course, as Cassidy is begging for Humperdue to come out from the clothes, Tulip walks in.
Yeah, do you think Humperdue is realizing – do you think he's just nervous, or do you think he is realizing, like, what is about to happen and he doesn't want that to happen?
Good question. We never, I guess another piece of the puzzle that we never really fully learned was how conscious Humperdue was.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Things like that. Yeah. I gotta believe he's just nervous.
Just nervous.
He knows it's a big thing. I don't think he knows exactly what. Now, when he goes into the clothes, is he saying to the moon again? Is he saying, I can't
yes,
remember.
I think he was saying that because that's kind of like his hiding spot.
So it could be that maybe he knows to the moon is actually also his sacrifice or something. So there could be some apprehension there. I think that's legit. Okay, so cut to the saint. He's fighting with the angel and the demon. The demon lady actually manages to get a cut on his face, which he's not happy about. But we cut away from that, back to Jesus and Hitler, still fighting. It's just an incredible, just all-out knockdown, drag-out, right?
Right.
Hitler calls Jesus a hippie wimp, and Jesus calls Hitler a fascist pig. And then we have multiple screens to show all the action going on from all of these characters.
Yeah.
And, of course, the countdown clock continues. So that was fun. A way to move the story forward very quickly with all these very fast cut scenes and to see that the movement is all taking place. Back in Australia. Yes, we're going back to Australia. Eugene is waking up from a hospital bed. So yeah, we have our answers, right?
And you kind of called what's about to happen, or halfway called what's about to happen.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Well, because I thought, what if the doctors work on
surgery,
his
yep.
face? And that is actually, so apparently his face was badly damaged. They did not know the extent of how his deformity was. Clearly the joke here is they did not know his deformity prior to this reconstructive surgery.
Right. I wonder if his face was even damaged at all in the accident.
It's true. I wonder why the whole time they're doing the surgery, they don't realize that they're not fixing jack shit. But anyway, it's a funny moment. His face is fully bandaged as he's waking up in the hospital bed. The doctor's starting to cut off the bandages and is telling him, you've had an accident, but you're going to be fine. You've suffered some facial trauma, but the plastic surgeons have been working all day and they've called it their passion project. As the bandage is removed, all of the doctors and nurses start to scream hysterically. Eugene looks in a mirror and sees that his face is the same as it was. So that was just a funny, funny Eugene moment. But don't worry, there's more to come. Back to the fighting is continuing between the saint and the angel and the demon. But at long last, the saint kills them both. As Effendi lies dying on the ground, Jesse crawls over to him and says, you know, hey, but you'll come back to life, right? And Effendi looks at the saint, shakes his head, says, I think that he, meaning the saint, can kill anything. And as the angel dies, he tells Jesse to do right, the right thing by their baby. And Jesse asks what that is, but the angel falls over dead before he can answer. And I thought I, too, would like an answer to that question. The saint then makes a big show of slashing up all the demon woman. And then Jesse sees one of the swords on the ground. He goes to try to pick it up. But the saint moves over to Jesse, steps on the sword. And Jesse says, okay, you win. And the saint cocks his gun and says, goodbye, preacher. You're going to hell. Holds the gun on Jesse. And Jesse closes his eye, and says, do you hear that? Peace and quiet. And then he opens his eye and looks back up at the saint and says, family picnics, planting a garden. That's what he's offering you, right? So if that's what you want, go on. One last kill, if that's what you really want. And we leave them there. So to be continued. That was a little mini cliffhanger in the middle of the show.
And you know what ends up happening with this too, and even as he's saying that, I think that's the reason why they made such a show of him slashing up the demon, because it just shows how it shows what he really enjoys doing, which is killing.
Yeah. So interesting that they cut away from this, and we don't really. We get a little bit of flashback of what happened, but we don't really see how the rest of this conversation went. Yeah. And another piece of the puzzle I would have liked.
Yeah.
So we get a quick scene. Jesus and Hitler still fighting. Now they're in full-on body slams. They're just throwing each other around now. Back to the dressing room. Tulip tells Cassidy, if Humperdew lives, everybody dies. And Cassidy says, not my problem. So Tulip punches Cassidy. And then Cassidy turns and tells Hump, says, Hump, go wait in the clothes. So nice callback there. Just, I think every time Cassidy calls Humperdew Hump, yeah. I smile a little bit. It's just so heartwarming. Tulip explains that she's loved Jesse since she was a little kid, and she understands that that sucks for Cassidy, but that's no reason to blow up the whole world. Then she demands Cassidy move out of her way so she can kill Humperdew herself. He refuses to move, so then she tries to explain and reason with him and says that he is her best friend. You know, no one makes me laugh like you do. No one loves him, and you know she loves you. I'm just going to speak like she's speaking. I have to start it over because of the interruption here. She says, you're my best friend. No one makes me laugh like you do, and you know I love you. But, and then he cuts her off and says, but only when you're sad and need a little shag.
Right.
So at that point, she punches him again. And then Cassidy says, he's got a bloody lip at this point, and he says, you've hurt me a lot. And honestly, I let it go because I love you. So I just let you hurt me. But I'm so done. And if you hit me again like that, I'm going to fucking kill you. And Tulip says she's sorry. And then the fight breaks out.
Yeah, this was a heartbreaking scene. Like, because I mean, it really does. It does finally show Cassidy admitting that he loves. You know, we've known he loves her, but that he loves her, and that he is kind of tired of her just only going to him when Jesse's not around, type of thing.
Yeah,
she's mad at Jesse, or Jesse's gone, and
yeah, he feels used.
Yeah,
legitimately so. His anger is completely legitimate. Interesting that it came down to saving Humperdew, that it, you know, that it came to this over saving Humperdew. But yeah, I think all of these tender moments with Joseph Gilgan that are all through this episode, including at the very end.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I know it'll never happen, but he really deserves an award for his performance. He really does. Anyway. Back in the arena, the Grail married couple are now straight on arguing in front of God. Something
yeah,
something very mundane. They turn to God and ask him to solve the, you know, the whatever their marital issue is. It was,
yeah, I love that he's, they're like the only ones even half paying attention that, you know, God is standing in this arena and yeah, all these people are fanatics and they don't even like care that he's there. They're barely caring that he's there, except they want something from him. He's just getting impatient.
Yeah. It was funny. And it is how you would imagine people would be if they, you know, if they met God for real. Anyway, so next scene, back to Featherstone, we see she is holding a gun on Star and calling him just another unbeliever and telling him to get on the tarp, which, as you remember, was his move whenever he was about to execute somebody, right, make a big production, lay out a tarp, etc. So Star explains to her that he has just gotten off the phone with the submarine commander in the Egyptian Navy. And while the world turns to ash, the two of them will make their escape. And she's somewhat listening to his plan as he goes on and says, we're going to live under the sea, you and I, eating, yoga, talking about books we like, and pleasuring you repeatedly with my anus. All of these, I think, just sound wonderful, you know, in his mind, I'm sure. And he says, I don't think you'll get that kind of offer from paradise, meaning heaven, which, of course, is where she thinks they're going. And then he continues, you're of great value to me, Flufferman, and you always have been. A tear rolls down Featherstone's cheek while she listens to all of these heartful words. But in the end, she says, sorry, sir, my name is Featherstone.
Boom.
So I did love that she finally corrected him. She goes to pull the trigger. We do hear a gunshot go off, and what we see is Featherstone instead falling to the ground dead, shot in the head, and that Star also had a gun in his desk, and he sets the smoking gun down on the desk.
Did you see that one coming?
No.
Yeah, I thought I didn't care that I thought he was about to get killed, because I thought it was kind of like, yes, but I did like that she gave her like, no, my name's Featherstone. They did it perfectly to set up that she kills him, but yeah. Nice little table turn there.
I like the table turn. I was fine with him killing Featherstone. However, I would have rather seen her kill him.
Yeah.
I know we needed a little more hilarity out of Pip Torrens, yes, and Hair Star, but I don't know. I would have rather seen her kill him and then team back up with Tula. But they would have, that would have just gotten too cockamamie.
But they did at least, like, she stood up for herself, so she did kind of get her role turn.
Yes, she did. But in the end, R.I.P. Featherstone.
Yes.
Very sad. Another great performance, Julianne Emery. Just fantastic. So next we see just a quick scene, a very puzzling scene, Dean.
Yes.
The saint is going down on his knees. Jesse is holding one of the angel's swords. And then he quickly slices the saint's throat and turns and walks out of the church as the saint falls over dead, seemingly allowing Jesse to do this to him. Now, I will say at this point, because you don't see this coming and it's a quick scene and it cuts away and you think, what the hell just happened? How did it come to this? How did Jesse manage to do this? So at this point, Sean, my husband, who's a huge fan of the source material and was going to be super pissed if the show didn't wrap up in a certain way. And P.S., this was not the way. So at that point, you know, it cuts to commercial. He stands up and he's like, okay, I'm done with this show. Is actually going to walk out of the room and not watch the last 30 minutes or whatever that's left. I had already seen it. So I was like, no, come back. Trust me, you cannot leave the show now. How dare you? I was appalled at the thought. But that's how mad that scene made him. And I imagine it fueled that kind of rage in several other fans as well.
Yeah, I just didn't like how – I think this is when I watched the episode the first time too, is until it was all wrapped up, I kind of just wasn't – it's not that I wasn't satisfied, but it's like they didn't have to keep doing the whole, like, we're going to show you part of it and then we'll go back later and show you what actually happened. Like, they've done that enough times. I wish they would have just maybe – structured the scenes with especially the saint and what happens with that just a little bit more linearly. It wouldn't have taken away from anything, I don't think. It does have a, it does make the reveal at the end a little bit better.
Yeah.
But
that's what it was in service to.
I would have almost rather they didn't even set it up. Just somehow Jesse like walks out from there and you just don't know what happened in general. Like you thought maybe he just beat him in a fight somehow, as opposed to making a whole to do out of the mystery of why all of a sudden he just like lets him kill him. I don't like that. It just seemed like he just gave up and let him kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't like that in the moment. I think it's
like
served,
I said, it makes sense at the end when right. you find out everything. I just didn't like the way they structured it.
I agree. And I think one additional flashback, if we were going to tell it non-linearly, if we were going to tell it in flashback style, which I'm okay with because of the significance of the reveal at the end with God and the saint. So I think that there, we could have stood for maybe one more flashback about Jesse telling Tulip, and even if it was exposition, but Jesse telling Tulip and Cassidy about his conversation with the saint. I just would have liked to have seen more of that conversation as he starts to convince the saint, here's a new plan, you know, or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. Anyway. So Tulip and Cassidy are continuing to fight in the dressing room, and I will say, and I'm sure you recognize this too, that this was another one of those great close quarter fight scenes that Preacher yes. does so well. It was just brilliantly choreographed and shot and edited.
Yes, and as always, Tulip will pick up any object around to try to kill somebody with.
Yes, of which she does find several objects, and she actually gets a few stabs in on Cassidy, once in the neck and I think once in the stomach or side.
Right.
And he also manages to pick her up and throw her into the mirror there yep. at the vanity table. So we cut away from that fight scene, and we're back in the nuclear launch site, where the two Grail officers are still waiting to pull the trigger. The Lady Grail officer is telling the male one that, you know, he has to dance, that the Messiah has to dance. That's
the yeah. So yeah, yeah, they're watching the clock at zero.
Yeah, even though the countdown is finished, they can't pull the trigger because the dancing is the signal.
So the world is saved by protocol.
Yes. For the first time ever.
Yes.
Back at Masada, the crowd is going crazy. They're shouting, kill us all from the crowd. The clock is at zero. No Messiah is dancing. Everybody's getting extremely restless. The Grail couple still squabbling over in front of God, and God convinces them that maybe they should go check on the Messiah.
Yeah, this is stupid.
Could also bring some help because he might have stage fright.
Like, surely so, God knows that if something's going wrong, it has to be Jesse. Like, yeah. How does he not know this?
Well, that's why he sent cronies in. He didn't want to go find out himself, and also he wanted those two people to shut the hell up. Yeah. So it was killing two birds with one stone, right?
Yeah.
So Tulip and Cassidy are continuing to fight. Humperdoo is still watching from the clothes. It's very adorable. And finally, I say it's adorable because he's like peeking out mm-hmm. his poor little sweet innocent face. Finally, Cassidy has a gun pulled on Tulip, and his face is so bloody, and he says, so you still think I'm the funniest? And she looks him right in the eye and says, yeah, I do, actually. And for whatever reason, that seems to break the tension between them, and there's a large Grail officer outside the door trying to bust the door down. Tulip tells Cassidy he knows what he has to do. Humperdoo is still whining behind the clothes. This is a very sad moment here. Cassidy reluctantly picks up the gun. He shoots Humperdoo in the head. So then Humperdoo's dead, lifeless body slowly emerges from the clothes. It was this weird kind of almost like out of a horror movie, because you know he's dead, but he kind of pops back out as he's falling from the clothes. And just then Jesse busts in. And we see that he's killed that Grail officer outside. And then we get a shot of God's face from the crowd coming to the conclusion that he knows he's lost. And then back in the dressing room, Cassidy and Tulip are crying over Humperdoo's body. And here's just one of my favorite Cassidy lines. He is saying about Humperdoo, he's the best person I ever met.
Yeah.
No bullshit, no agendas.
He liked everyone, even assholes. It's just how I felt when I was with him, you know? And then Cassidy is full on sobbing and says, he was really special. It was really sad, dude. It pulled my heartstrings. And again, Joseph Gilgan nailed it.
And that I didn't want him to kill Humperdew. I wanted Cassidy and Humperdew to like ride off in the sunset together.
I know.
Like him be like his you know, protector and like father figure for the rest of the days.
I kind of knew Humperdew had to die though for it, everything to fall into place. So I just couldn't see a scenario where he could live.
Why? So. Just if they defeat God, they can still save Humperdew. Jesus got to live.
I know. Well, we'll get on to Jesus. I really do feel like Jesus was the better of the two. I know Humperdew I know he pulls at our heartstrings, but he was an abomination. It wasn't right what he was being set
he
up.
He never hurt anybody.
I know. It was awful. It was brutal, too. That's not how it went down with Humperdew in the comics. We talked about that last episode. I think Cassidy having to do it, especially Cassidy, who loved him so much, that was really heartbreaking.
Right.
Probably fucked Cassidy up for the rest of his life, right? I mean, that could be why he kept a distance from his loved ones, as we learned later in the coda. You know, maybe this was a moment here that really made him realize, I just can't be around people I love.
Well, and we talked about this too, even when we had the discussion about Cassidy and the farmer, when I said I still don't think he ate the farmer. I think he was trying to get the farmer to, he was trying to offend the farmer enough for him to attack him or to say something to kind of let him do it. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing with Tulip here. He goes completely, you know, like he's about to kill her. And I think he would have killed her had she have spat back at him. When he asked her if you still think I'm the funniest, but he tried to do his worst to make her hate him, mm-hmm. and she didn't. And so he's turned around a lot. And I think Humperdew has shown him that he has someone who never, you know, never disliked anybody, who liked everybody. And he kind of saw that he could do that too.
Yeah. Well, it's like he said, it's just how I felt when I was with him. Yeah. And we saw throughout, especially this season, that Humperdew had that effect on everybody that he was around, especially those Jewish people.
Especially those Jews, yeah.
All right. Oh, my gosh. The longest fight ever continues. Hitler and this continuing to fight. And
That's my favorite line of the whole. So great.
Yeah. So great. Jesus is finally has Hitler on the ground. He's choking him. Hitler calls Jesus a Jew, and Jesus says, you're goddamn right, and finally chokes him to death. And as the life is draining out of Hitler, God walks in. And Jesus, like a little kid, jumps up and tries to stand in front of the body and quickly grabs like a towel and tries to cover him up, too, so that God can't see. It was so funny. And so God says, okay, son, it's time. It's time for you to be the Messiah finally. All right. Out in the arena, the crowd is shouting, Messiah, Messiah. And Jesse walks on stage and they all start to boo him. And then he uses the word to make them listen to him. And back to God and Jesus. God is confused because Jesus has clearly turned his offer down. Jesus explains it used to be what he wanted, but really he's just a man, no worse, no better than anybody. Who is he to be a Messiah? So then God tries to blow him off by saying, you know, I don't really need you. This is all just showbiz. I can blow the whole thing up myself at any time. So then Jesus tries to ration with him and says, or you could be merciful, patient, and tolerant. And loving. And God says, loving? And Jesus begins a Bible quote. And these three things remain, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these, but before he can say is love, God storms off.
Yeah, I love that. Because it's another time where they make it seem like, oh, well, maybe he is going to change his mind. And Jesus will be the one to help. Oh, nope.
No, God's too far gone.
So then we get this funny, it's a funny scene, but I want to dissect it a little bit. So God's out in the hallway waiting for the elevator. He sees Star kind of getting, you know, across the hallway, holding a bunch of suitcases, acting like he's also trying to get the hell out of there. And they spy each other from across the room. God yells at him to run, and then Hairstar does, just start running in the opposite direction. And then God gets in an elevator, and then on a motorcycle, and then we see him hightailing it the hell out of town. So what was that between God and Star? That was that just God exerting his power, like trying to scare? I mean, what?
Yeah,
idle threat
I think
that?
Basically Star got caught, you know, dipping out, and and I think God was, you know, I think it was more of just like God doesn't really probably care at this point because he's leaving, but he also realizes he did kind of catch him doing something bad. And so it's like almost his way of just like, I don't have time for this, so I'll just scare the hell out of him. And I think it was a way for him just to freak him out, but he didn't have time to go deal with it.
Oh, yes, I agree with that. But also to expand on what you said too. So God catches Star, but also maybe Star is catching God also.
Right, so
and so God is intimidating him to make him not realize the situation here.
Right, they both catch each other bailing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of funny. So back in the Masada Arena, Jesse looks into the camera, which is broadcasting this, and uses the word and tells everybody watching this horseshit talent show to turn their TVs off. At which point, we see the Grail officers from that launch site turn their TVs off, and then one Grail officer remarks, well, that was disappointing.
Yeah.
So the threat has now ended. Back in Eugene's hospital room, it's the middle of the night. A doctor enters the room, and he attempts to sympathize with Eugene. He says, you know, he can't do much, but what he can do is turn off all these machines and make it so that, you know, the heart monitor and those types of things won't alert the people outside. And then he says to Eugene, you know, so that you can lie back with your and lay your burdens down. And then he gives Eugene the morphine pen and says, just press it again and again, and then you're free. So he's basically attempting an assisted suicide here, thinking that Eugene must not want to live with himself based on how he looks. Then Eugene gives this great monologue, and he's, you know, crying throughout. And as his speech grows stronger, there's spittle and things coming from his mouth as he gets, as you know, he is attempting to tell this doctor off. He says, for 18 years, he's been laughed at and teased and puked on. And you want to know what the worst part of it is? Assholes like you feeling sorry for me, because I'm fine. I'm fine. And you know what? I'm better than fine. I'm Eugene Edward Root, so screw you. And as he is just attempting to scream all of this, it is just some great acting as this spit and saliva is just flying from his mouth. And this is Eugene's Phoenix moment, right?
Right, yeah. I thought it was a little over-serious. I kept waiting for something, you know, some kind of sight gag or something to happen in the middle of him.
I think we needed it because we needed the momentum that drives Eugene to his final point,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So we needed him to take that stand, and I agree. It could have, you know, it is what it is. It was a low-budge way to do it, I guess. Because we never even saw the doctor. And that was
right.
Solely
yeah.
Just the doctor was off-screen. Could have been anybody for all we know. All right, back to the stage in Masada. Jesse is now telling the Grail people in the stands that God is gone. God is on the run again. And then Jesse kind of gets into like this quiet monologue himself. He says he's been searching for him for so long, such a long time, so long that he can't remember not searching for him. And what does he have to show for it? What good has it done him other than make him see the worst in himself and miss the best in others that he cares about? So he looks back out at the crowd and he says, okay, so I'm going to stop looking. and that's where you fascist assholes come in. No matter where he runs, no matter how long it takes, I want him found. And then he uses the word and says, so go find him. And then in a very orderly fashion, all of the gray people stand and begin to form single file lines and march on out to follow their orders, possibly until the end of time. Jesse has just sent them on a mission, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. The scene where they're all marching was actually a neat scene where they played with the showing it from different angles in, mm-hmm. in a split screen. It was cool. All right. When you thought you didn't get enough Eugene is back on the street, ready to start singing again. He's got his guitar. Now it's the same guitar because we know this because it's all covered in duct tape.
Yeah.
So that's hilarious that the guitar made it through the accident as well. He opens his guitar case, throws some coins in, and he starts singing Closing Time again. And people are just walking by and not paying any attention to him. And he continues to sing and still getting no reactions. So he's looking around and decides, all right. And he switches gears with his musical choice. And he starts to play the guitar very fast and loud and starts his own rendition of a song by the Circle Jerks called Stars and Stripes. Were you a fan of the Circle Jerks, Dean?
Never heard of them until I saw what this song was.
So the Circle Jerks were a punk rock band, pretty popular in the 80s. I liked them. But anyway, I didn't recognize the song until the music came on over it. And then, of course, when I watched it with subtitles. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he starts doing that, that really starts to draw the crowd around him. So he has found his style.
Yeah, and they kind of make the, which I think they did this earlier maybe, but that, yeah, as he's playing it, you almost hear like crowd noises as if like he were in an arena singing it. So it does kind of like foreshadow that
Yes. This
might be what takes him on.
Yes. Next, we see Tulip, Jesse, and Cassidy. They are now standing.
That's the last we see of Eugene, actually see Eugene, right?
It is. But we do get another little Easter egg at the end.
Yep, nice little nod at the end.
So good. And if you blink, you miss it. So anyway, Tulip and Jesse and Cassidy are standing in the empty Masada Arena now. And Cassidy... This was a funny, again, the three of them together. I think this is also the last time we see the three of them together. So it was an important moment, which they also had to sprinkle in the hilarity. So it was a great moment by all three of these actors, but especially Joseph Gilgan, again, as Cassidy. Cassidy says, you know, they saved the world. The three of them saved the world in a literal sense. And Jesse says, yeah, not too many people can say that, huh? And so Cassidy begins to make a list of people who actually can say that. And he says Churchill, Lincoln, Frodo Baggins. And Jesse and Tulip look at him, and Jesse says, you know, Frodo Baggins is fictional. And Cassidy is acting confused, and Jesse says, the man with the furry little feet who lives with a wizard is fictional, Cassidy. And Cassidy begins to argue that, first of all, that wizard only came to fit. but that conversation is cut short as Tulip exclaims loudly, to the end of the world. And as they're all looking at each other, she says, all right, now what?
Yeah, they are. Even when they first come out there, it's even though it is very anticlimactic for them. They're just kind of like, oh, cool. I guess we did it, huh? Yeah, great.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that was the show's way, I think, of kind of saying, all right.
Yep.
There was your climax. There you go. All right. Next, we see a shot. We get another screenshot. It's Texas, 2 years later. Jesse and Tulip are running in the streets. We learn they're running from the Rodriguez brothers, who are hot on their tail. And they find themselves trapped in a potential shootout. They're kind of hiding behind in an alley. Tulip looks out and assesses that there's 8 of the Rodriguez brothers and only 2 of them, meaning her and Jesse. But it's okay. They have some rolling papers and they have a gun. and up there, there's some power lines. So, you know, she's working up a plan, clearly going to MacGyver them out of there. And she asks Jesse if he has his lighter, and he's just kind of staring at her, kind of smiling. And she starts to take that as his lighter's gone again. So she starts to chastise him like, oh, you haven't lost it again, have you? And he says, no, 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 pulls the lighter out of his pocket and throws it at her and says, you know, I'm just happy. So this was a nice little scene to let us see that 2 years later, they're still up to whatever shenanigans they enjoy getting up to. There's even a mention, I think Jesse says, you know, I could just use the word and make them all throw their guns down. So they're making the choice to still continue on these different fights. And this is enough of a exposition in this conversation to see that they're also happy.
Yeah. And we've always mentioned how Jesse prefers to end things with his hands, if possible, as opposed to using the word if he doesn't have to.
And also, I think it was important to note that Jesse still had that lighter. So it tied up all of those things in that great scene.
Yep.
So they return to the garage and in the carport. They get turned to the garage. There's a mechanic there working on a car. And I guess whatever they were trying to steal from the Rodriguez brother worked, because they give it to the man and putting it back in the car and saying how this woman can finally get her car back or whatever. So it was kind of funny and goofy.
Yeah, they're in a big shootout for a car part.
Yeah, exactly. And when the guy looks up, we see, oh my gosh, it's the barkeep from the Holy Bar and Grail. Cool. And they ask him, how'd the night go? And he says, oh, you know, only one accident, but otherwise everything's fine. And it's like, what? And we see them, Tulip and Cassidy, walk into are they still at the Holy Bar and Grail? No, they're in Texas.
No, because they're in Texas, yeah.
Yeah, they walk into the house, I guess that's attached to this garage, and they walk into a little baby's room. And there's a baby in a crib, Dean.
Yep.
It's their baby girl. And they just are immediately, and we understand that the accident now, the one accident earlier was clearly a diaper accident. So sweet moment here. They're looking over the baby. They're actually talking a little bit too. They talk about Cassidy and how he has recently called and he's off having fun at a peyote conference.
Right.
And that he sounded okay. And apparently he threw up with Woody Harrelson. And as they continue to just coo over the baby, Jesse tells Tulip that she looks just like her and that he just can't stop saying that. And Tulip says that's okay. She likes to hear it.
Yeah, and it looks looks just like her.
Yeah,
I mean, looks just like her.
Just like her. Different hair, but other than that, spitting image. Yes. So then Jesse gets a phone call, and as he walks in the other room to take the phone call, there was a picture of Humperdew on the wall next to the phone. I loved that.
Yeah.
Then back in the room, Tulip is singing a beautiful but kind of somber lullaby to the baby. And there is a little focus on the mobile hanging above the baby's crib. It's full of dinosaurs. And the camera kind of lingers on that. I'm sure that's a callback to, you know, the dinosaurs from God's creation.
Yeah.
But of course, Dean, as is our wont to tie every show back to Legion, I wrote down, here's our first Legion tie-in, the baby mobile. So maybe a stretch. Yeah. Maybe a stretch.
No, that was very deep imagery in the Legion series. So
It was. It was very important. I've got another one coming up in a minute, too. But I was like, woohoo, we made it. Here's another Legion reference, the baby mobile. So, folks, if you don't know what we're talking about, go back and watch Legion and then listen to our coverage. So then Jesse walks in. He lets Tulip know that the Grail folks that he sent out on their mission have finally found God, and he's in San Antonio. Jesse himself has to go.
Yeah, as soon as they said San Antonio, I knew exactly where it was going to be.
Yes, and I will say, too, for all the comic fans out there, they will know this is where Jesse and God have the showdown in the comic books, also at the Alamo. So I was glad they did this. Next scene is Jesse walking toward the Alamo. All of the Grail officers that have spent 2 years trying to find him are standing there vigilant. They're very weathered and weary. God is just camped out very blatantly in front of the Alamo in his Winnebago. God invites Jesse to come sit with him, and Jesse turns and uses the word to dismiss all the Grail officers. This is the funny moment. Not really, shouldn't be funny, but it was. It was preacher funny. Where they turn and they're starting to walk off, and some of them actually just drop dead. So once Jesse and God are alone, Jesse finally uses the word on God. He's testing it. He forces God to make it day and then make it night, and proves that indeed he does have that ability to use the word on God, as God will throw up his hand and make it day and make it night upon Jesse's command. So then God says, all right, now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's sit down and have a chat. Can I offer you a beer, a soda pop, Diet Dr. Pepper? So got the Diet Dr. Pepper callback.
That's right.
Couldn't get the Big Lebowski callback, but no. We got that Diet Dr. Pepper product.
It's greatest creation.
Yeah. So next they're seated in lawn chairs in front of the Winnebago, and Jesse is telling God that he has so many questions. And God says, go ahead. And Jesse says, okay, well, kids with cancer. And God says, yes, you know, suffering is a great teacher. It gives a person great strength. And Jesse says, or it kills them. And God says, well, it teaches strength to those left behind. So then Jesse asks if all the other religions are wrong. And God says, no. He admires a lot about all those other faiths. And Jesse says, yeah, but they're going to hell, right? God says, no, not necessarily. So then Jesse asks about life on other planets, and God starts laughing and says, no. And then a lady walks out of the trailer, and she's wearing Daisy Dukes and a tied up shirt. She's, you know, I wouldn't necessarily put this moniker on her, but some would say very Trailer Park Trash style. Yes. But she says, we're out of bean dip, and do you want anything from the Piggly Wiggly? And they both say no, and then she walks off. So that was just a little comic relief. For those who don't know what the Piggly Wiggly is, Dean and I are in Georgia, so we certainly know, but the Piggly Wiggly is a grocery store chain. Yes. There are actually still several out there. Oh, yeah.
There's one there's one down the road from where I'm working.
Yes, there's one not too far from me also. They tend to be more in rural areas, but anyway.
Where ladies like that lady in the trailer tend to shop.
Great place to pick up some bean dip when you're out. So, yeah.
God has shown he has a penchant for trashy women throughout the show. So,
Yes, he does. And he seems to have a real looker on his hands. Anyway, and if she's chowing down on bean dip, Anyway, okay. Then God asks Jesse, what else does he want to know? And I love all these questions that Jesse is asking God, because it really does seem like if you had a chance to really have a conversation with God, these are kinds of questions you would ask. So I really appreciate the writers doing these questions. But then Jesse, the real question that was on Jesse's mind finally comes out, and he asks if his dad is in heaven. And God starts to speak of what a devout man Jesse's father was, you know, never said a curse word, never had a bad thought, never even cracked a Playboy. And then he says, I remember you, Jesse, how hard you prayed for your father that he would burn in the fires of hell. And as Jesse starts to cry, God says, I denied your prayers. He's in heaven, of course. And Jesse lets out a large sigh of relief. And God explains to him that the moment he let Jesse's father died, every moment that has followed in Jesse's life was an expression of his love. He tells Jesse that he loves him, and he asks Jesse if he believes him. And Jesse says, yes. And God says, good. Now it's your turn to say it back. This is a light bulb moment for Jesse. He figures out that God's great design is the need to be loved. And God says, yeah, just say it. Just come on, just say it to me. I'll even go back to heaven. All you have to do is say it. And Jesse laughs and says, I get it. I understand. But we would be better off without a needy little bitch like you around. And as Beethoven Symphony No. 9 begins to play, Jesse uses the word to start tossing God around, really beating up. God's taking a beating here. And he says to God, do whatever you want around here. That's fine. But I'm warning you, stay out of heaven and leave us alone. And God says, you're only doing what you're doing because you have this perverse power. And Jesse says, be free. And we see Genesis fly out of him, fly out of his chest and into the sky, very much like the comic book. And then God says, why? And here Jesse gets his opportunity to drop the F-bomb. And yep. He says, because I don't fucking need it. And then he punches God in the face. And then God stands up using his God voice and says, I will rip you apart and gorge your innards and pick my teeth with your bones. And Jesse says, it still won't make me love you. And God says, I'm a loving God, Jesse, but my patience with you and my patience with all of humanity is nearing an end. You will return my affection or your replacement awaits. And he looks at his Winnebago. And Jesse says, yeah, we have our flaws, but humanity is a miracle. In one that you should be proud of, that you've got. And if you've got something better cooking up in there, then by all means, go for it. Meantime, I'm going to go see a movie. And then he walks off and God goes back into his trailer. Oh, this was also heartbreaking, Dean. All of those creatures that are still in cages that we never see, but this time we can hear them and they're cooing and making all these loving noises. And the translation on the screens are all saying that these creatures are saying, Daddy, I love you. I love you, Daddy. Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And here was our other Legion reference. Yep. Because if Legion didn't kill the word daddy, this show put the pin in it, right? Because it's awful hearing them coo and call God daddy and express their love.
Oh, I didn't find it nearly as creepy because he's actually, at least it was in a father sense as opposed to, you know, Hey, my Snoopies, daddy loves you.
It's kind of similar though, because God made these things solely to love him. And, right. And David Holler kind of had those acolytes on hand just for nothing but to give him love. So, Legion parallel number two, folks, in one episode. But anyway, as they're still screaming, Daddy, I love you, God just goes crazy and starts ripping them all apart. It's just really very horrific and awful. It was just, we don't really see it. We just see the blood splattering all over his face and hear their
squeals and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awful. All right, final scenes. We did it. okay. Jesus is working at a hardware store now. And he's helping customers. He's being very patient throughout. There's a father and daughter that are there in line, you know, talking about the paint they maybe don't want to buy. And Jesus is explaining the return deal and how all that works and really giving it the hard sell. But the significance of this scene, Dean, did you catch it the first time? Did you?
Yeah, the T-shirt.
Yes, there's a girl standing next to her dad. She's ignoring him, of course. She's on her cell phone, but she's wearing a black shirt that has Eugene's face on it in great, like, death metal font that says Eugene, the World Tour. And the camera even pans around behind them for a glimpse of the back of the shirt where all the cities and dates are listed, and it even says sold out across the back of the shirt. So that's all we need to know that Eugene has made it. He's on a world tour that is sold out, right?
Rockstar.
What a great way to wrap that up. What a great way to show that without telling.
Yeah.
I really appreciated that. And I do believe that there's a good chance a lot of people missed it.
I'm sure.
It was very subliminal is not quite the right word, but it was not.
It was subtle. Yeah, it was very subtle.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So there is a funny moment there where Jesus finishes helping the customer, and then under his breath, he mutters dick as the guy walks off. And then he looks up and smiles and says, who's next?
Right.
So I love that Jesus is working out his final days in customer service. It's perfect. Yes. Perfect. Okay, but here's one scene that really wasn't perfect, but also it kind of was.
This is my favorite scene.
Hair Star is now on a golf course having a grand old time. D, Dana's hair has grown out into these gorgeous blonde flowing locks down to his shoulders. He's working the Farrah Fawcett hair. He's looking healthy and vibrant, you know, playing golf, says he's going to marry his 9-iron, having a great game. And then, oh my God, no one expected it. Call the police. It happened.
I know. I was believe it. It so excited.
Exactly Monty Python style. You called it. I squeal. I was like, no one expects the Pensacola police. It's happening.
Yeah.
They come storming in on a golf cart. They are hot on pursuit of Hairstar. The chief of police jumps out. You know, Hairstar says, "Who are you? We're the Pensacola police." It was just perfect. And then it is very Monty Python style because Hairstar is running from them. The song in the background is "Glory, Glory, What of a Hell of a Way to Die." It's a "Glory, Glory, Hallelujah" rendition, but instead it's "What a Hell of a Way to Die." Finally, the chief manages to knock him to the ground and is lying on top of him, trying to get handcuffs around him. Star is on the ground on his stomach, starts making this weird kind of movement. The chief jumps off of him. His deputy, who's standing there next to him, exclaims, "Oh my God, he's jacking off."
Yeah, the old Humperdoo defense.
Yes, we see from their angle, it does very much look like that is what he's doing. But then as he spins around, simultaneously, the chief realizes he's been pickpocketed and his gun is missing. And Hairstar spins around and shoots them both dead. So he had the jack-off fake out in order to be able to pickpocket you and also kill you. Pretty crafty, Hairstar. Oh, yeah. Pretty crafty. And next we see that their bodies are in the sand trap and Star is just continuing his golf game. So it was funny and it was awesome. And I loved the callback to the Pensacola police. I love that we thought that that would have been so funny if it happened. And then it did, never expecting it to.
Yes.
What I don't love is that I don't feel that this was a fair nor satisfying ending for Hairstar.
I liked it. I think, especially as he has the bodies buried and not just he playing golf, but the three guys he's with, they're all just like continuing on to as if like, okay, like, so he's obviously got some more acolytes behind him, you know, or some people that are cool with him just murdering unconditionally.
They're probably the ones that he is now pleasuring with his anus.
It's definitely, he's, you can tell how happy he is. He's definitely pleasuring some people with that anus of his. So I kind of thought maybe he gets arrested and he thinks like everything's bad in jail and then realizes it would have been the best place for him to. So if he were in jail, he could, you know, be pleasuring all sorts of people with his anus.
This is true. I either wanted him to die in a horrible, horrible way. I just don't feel like he deserved to live nor live happily, as heinous as he was. What I really wanted to see, because I loved it so much in the comic books, we talked about it, that Jesse does it to Hoover in the comics. I thought it would have been a perfect role reversal to do to Star, to use the word on him to make him count sand.
Yeah.
To realize, like, I can't kill you, but you don't deserve to just have this wonderful life. You can count pebbles of sand on the beach every single day until you've counted them all, and by the way, the tide comes in every night and you have to start over every morning. So I really feel like I love the Pensacola police, don't get me wrong. I just really feel like there should have been another little bit of finality with Jesse and Star.
Yep.
That guy gave him too much grief to just be able to get away with it all. Anyway, God now is returning to heaven. He's walking into his throne room. He sees dead angel army all around. He yells out, "You slaughter the heavenly host." And the saint walks in the room and says, "They got in my way, so I tore them apart like a wet sheet." God asks why the saint was not sent to hell. And this is where we see the flashback. The saint says, "Deathbed confession." And we do see this flashback of Jesse and the saint back in the church with Jesse sitting down and the saint praying over him, or down on his knees, head bowed down, confessing to all of his sins, all of the killings, and how much he enjoyed it. So it was very fast. helps you to realize that, yes, this conversation where Jesse was saying to him, are these the things he promised you, clearly led to them concocting a plan of, why don't I send you to heaven and you get the opportunity to kill God in heaven while you can just wait for him up there. Mm-hmm. And the way I get you to heaven is through this deathbed confession. So these were the things that clearly they worked out amongst themselves, and we only get this little flash of, and I just would have liked more.
Yeah.
But anyway, he says, God says preacher, you know, knows this is preacher's doing when the saint says deathbed confession. And the saint says, yeah, he knew you'd come back here sometime and figured that you and I had some unfinished business. And then he says very ominously, he figured right. And the standoff starts to ensue. The saint has his hands ready on his holster for his guns. God has his arms down by his side with his little electric fingers. And God starts to just try to talk to him. First, trying to be intimidating. He yells at him using the God voice, tells him to stand aside. Of course, the saint's having none of that. Then God tries to be sympathetic, calls him William, says he just can't understand what it's like to be a creator in a time before creation. Infinite loneliness. So out of nothing, I created love. My greatest gift, William, allow me to take my throne and give it to you. God promises to return back his family, his little girl. He says how he loves them so. And what has been taken shall now be returned. Stand aside and let me give you an eternity of love. Now, the saint is definitely moved by this proposition. He's got some teary eyes. But in the end, he looks at God and says, what if I choose hate? And then he pulls out his gun, and God cocks his electric finger also. But the saint is faster, and he shoots God in the head, and God just falls over dead. And the saint walks up to the throne and sits on it and assumes the throne of heaven and rule of heaven. And that scene where the saint walks up and just, you know, sits down on the throne and kind of cocks his leg back and is all relaxed and chill and clearly in charge, that was a straight rendition from a comic book panel. 100%. Brilliant. Brilliant. Bringing that panel to life, that iconic panel from Preacher.
Is that how he ends up in the comic? He ends up in charge of heaven?
Yes.
Does it give any aftermath to it?
So in the comic, so I guess it's safe to say that, yes, he kills God, assumes the throne of heaven, and then kind of does this because now he's in charge. He's got God's power. And he does this kind of like reset kind of thing where it just kind of goes back. The coda is just Jesse and Cassidy and Tulip just kind of all together looking out. I think they're back in California or something, which is where they started in the comic book, I believe, maybe Texas. But they're kind of just looking out at the ocean or kind of just standing there like it never happened. Like they're all just three friends and they're all good. Hmm. So it's a little ambiguous at the end of the comic if he actually reversed time or, you know, how he set things right, but that's what you're led to believe. But yes, he does kill God and he does take the throne of heaven. And that is the one thing that Sean was like, if that doesn't happen in the show, I'm going to be so mad. Like, he wanted that so bad. So
yeah, like, it was cool, but I don't see what the point of it was. Like, I don't understand how would heaven work now that you have a psychopath. Well, I guess God was kind of a psychopath, too.
Yeah.
So, in the comic, does anybody take over hell?
Nope, it's not addressed in the comic. Yeah, but the saint does kill Satan, so it's not addressed. Yeah,
I wanted someone in. I still think it would have been funny if Jesus ended up running hell.
Yeah, or somebody. Hairstar, maybe.
Yeah, he would have been. He would have been good down there.
All right.
Yeah,
I agree. That I guess they probably left that dangling a little bit. But we get this great scene: Tulip and Jesse and their little baby girl are in the back seat. They're all at a drive-in movie, and they're watching a John Wayne movie. Another callback to the comic books. It is very clear that they are happy. And we do get this great shot of Genesis flying through the night sky. And finally, kind of a sad moment here for this final scene. Bittersweet. They gave us this really bittersweet, very somber moment here. But we get a title card that says 40 years later. And now there are gravestones for Jesse and Tulip. And Jesse's gravestone reads 1979 to 2065. This is Jesse Custer, 1979 to 2065. And then in quotes, one of the good guys. Love that. Tulip's gravestone reads Tulip in quotes. And underneath that, Priscilla Jean Henrietta O'Hare. 1983 to 2064. So she died a year earlier than Jesse. Yep. A woman is standing by the grave. She looks a lot like Ruth Negga, Dean.
That's right. She looks just like her.
But we know it's not Tulip because we're looking at Tulip's grave and it's 40 years later, but she's the spitting image of Tulip just with longer hair. And of course we learn this is Tulip and Jesse's daughter.
Right.
We never learn her name, which I kind of wish we had.
Mm-hmm.
Cassidy suddenly is next to her and they're chatting and he says, oh, I hear you're a banker now, is that right? And she starts to explain her job, that she's runs an asset management fund and all that it entails, to which he's clearly not understanding any of it. Then their conversation turns a little more serious. She says she's been praying a lot lately and doesn't really know why. And Cassidy says, no, I get it, and I think your daddy would too. She says that he told her that Cassidy once killed 20 angels with a chainsaw and drank a gallon of gasoline. Is that true? And he says, well, yeah, a little exaggerated. It was actually engine coolant. That's funny. Then she says that Jesse told her that you were the toughest guy he ever met. And Cassidy says that means a lot coming from him. And then she says, Mom talked about you all the time, too. She wondered why you never came back to see them. And he says, I always meant to, you know, but I always ran out of time. And she just says, yeah, I get it. She loved you very much. And he says, you know, I'm over 150 years old, and I've been through a lot. I've been thrown out of an airplane, been stabbed, been shot. But I just keep going, and that's what you do. You pick yourself up. You forget the pain, and you try to carry on. But your mom, you know, she shot me twice in the chest, right in the heart, two times. And that was years ago, but it still hurts. And the daughter actually, during this beautiful heartfelt speech, actually turns around to her own children who are running around. So this lets us know that mm-hmm. Jesse and Tulip actually had grandchildren too.
Yep.
And she gets on to them very Tulip O'Hare style, tells them to quit messing and be respectful. And then she turns back to Cassidy and he says, okay, I think I'll get going. And she said, I always did love hearing about your adventures. Where are you going to head to now? And he says, well, I think I'll try someplace new. And as he's walking off, she says, Mr. Cassidy, will we ever see you again? And he looks at her in his signature accent and says, Jesus, I hope so. Then as he's walking out of the shade, he hangs his umbrella on a nearby tombstone and we can see him in the background walking into sunlight, catching on fire and burning up. The end. I'm a little teary-eyed right now.
Yeah, it was a nice little, it was a good way to end it, I thought. Because I was kind of upset that they kind of didn't have Cassidy in the epilogue.
Yeah.
You know, like that he wasn't there when they were running around from the Rodriguez brothers or anything after with God or anything. So I had kind of gotten, you know, kind of missing him. And then I thought it was a good way to him to say goodbye. And it does it for them to be dead. I like that he chooses that he'll, and again, the way he says it, almost hoping maybe they'll see each other in the afterlife type of thing.
Yeah. I hope so. And that was the Jesus, I hope.
Yes,
so.
Right, yeah.
You know, he can't live forever. And I guess he thought, well, now that my friends are dead, there's no point. And he also right. is
sadly lamenting to their daughter that, you know, he always meant to come back and visit more, but he just, you know, life got in the way and he never did. And I think he's very sad about that too. So it was sad. It was a sad end. It was a happy and also very sad ending.
Yeah. And then he walked away like, walked away like it was a Prodigy music video. And then was that... Is that the band where that music video, the guy's running on fire? Maybe it's not Prodigy.
I don't know. It's not a band. Not a band I'm super into, so I wouldn't know, but I'll take your word for it. I'm glad that we have another Garth Ennis property called The Boys over on Amazon. I'll be excited for season two of that. Because this
Have they announced anything about that?
I'm sorry?
Have they announced anything about that yet? If I know they've said it is coming, or in fact that they didn't even, they might have greenlit two seasons already, I think.
Well, I'll be excited to hear that. I know it's in production.
Okay.
That's all I know. So, but Sean follows Garth Ennis and Garth Ennis News very closely, and I guess a couple of his other properties might also be in discussions. There's one in particular, if you just want more Garth Ennis in your life, should definitely look up his comic books. You can find all of them in trade paperback form if you don't want to get single issue. But Garth Ennis has just completed a 12 arc series called A Walk Through Hell. And Sean is pretty positive that is going to be made into a show as well. He says it is fantastic. I myself have not read it. And it's also dark. Clearly it's called A Walk Through Hell. So,
yeah.
So radios and anybody who is still listening, Dean and I have been watching lots and lots and lots of shows, and I know we've teased that we want to talk American Horror Story. So we're going to do another episode where we kind of talk about all these other lots and lots of shows that we've also been watching, because we have things to say, not scene by scene breakdown, but we have things to say and recommendations to make. And then we're going to move, and we're going to cover American Horror Story as part of that little one-off episode or two-off episodes where we talk about all the things you should be watching. And then we're going to scoot straight into our Watchmen coverage.
Yep.
Now, I'll say the most anticipated show of the year for me, Watchmen. So, I, from what I've read, for people who got early screeners of it, it lives up. I have no doubt I'm going to love it. So, I'm just, you know, my expectations are high, but I have no doubt. So, we will be back at with you. We will be back at you very soon with another episode of Mike TV. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to sign off and let Dean give our Twitter handles, and we'll be back again with Watchmen coverage and all the TV you can handle.
All right. Follow us on Twitter at MikeTV1. You can find me at Rockdale_Tiger, either one of those. Drop us a line, hit us up with a question, let us know what you're watching and what you want us to watch or what we should watch as well. You can also find us or contact us through the Radio Labyrinth fan page on Facebook, The Radio Shack, and of course also find information about us on www.radiolabyrinth.com.
Yes, and I'm going to make it a personal... I keep saying this, but I'm going to personally commit to setting up an email for us and maybe an Instagram so that people can DM us and also email us directly.
Okay.
Because we really want to read your comments, and not everybody's on Twitter. I get it. So we want you to interact with us, and we want to be able to read your feedback and comments. Even if you tell us how much we suck and you hate us, we'll read that too. So yeah, we'll be fair. We'll be fair and balanced. All right. So until next time, thanks again, everybody.
Bye, Lisa.
Bye, Dean.